listening to SheShield, your one-stop shop for all things personal safety. I'm your host, Sophia, and my goal is to help educate women and men on concealed carry, martial arts, and all topics self-defense. Today, we have John and Sarah Helpman, the owners of Filster, a holster brand that has transcended all other modes of concealment. As someone who uses the Filster Enigma holster daily to conceal and recommends it as much as possible to those who have watched my concealment journey, I cannot be more excited to have them on the show today to share their story and wisdom. So I would love if you would first introduce yourself and your path to founding Filster.
Well, first, thanks very much for having
us. Thank you, yeah.
Yeah, we've been, I remember the first time I started seeing your videos, I'm like, this person is doing something clever, and we are definitely going to keep our eye on what she's doing, and it's been really great.
Thank you.
I'm going to let Sarah do the introduction. Because the last time I had to tell the founding story and go into all the background, she wrote wrap it up really big on the piece of notepaper we have here.
No, the only reason I did that was because it wasn't a podcast about us. It was a podcast about our friend John Murphy's class, and I was like, okay, I love this story, okay. And John actually tells the founding story really well. But I was like, okay. But we're like 10 minutes into this podcast about John Murphy, and we haven't talked about John Murphy yet. Maybe we should.
You know, I tell the story really long, so it builds up and amplifies the amount of credit that you get for it.
You know what? And I appreciate that. You are really good about that.
But it's your turn to do it.
Really oh, boy. Cool. Well, now I won't even do it justice, so it'll just be funny. But so John and I own Filster Holsters, which is a company that makes kind of cutting edge concealment gear. The thing that we are now best known for is the Filster Enigma, which is a system that allows you to carry with the stability and concealment of a belt, but without wearing a belt. So that's kind of our flagship product now. But the company started in 2010-ish. And what actually happened was John was interested in Kydex holsters, and he went to go look around and buy one. And the wait times were like astronomical. You know, it was like an 8-week wait. 16-week wait to even get anything. And so John was looking around, and he thought to himself, you know, I'm a pretty smart guy. I think in 16 weeks, I could teach myself how to do this. And he did. Not only that, but he put his entire journey on YouTube so people could follow along and learn along with him. And up until then, all this stuff was like trade secrets, very highly protected knowledge. And John was the first one to really put all of this online, which was really cool and spawned this whole kind of homemade DIY Kydex revolution. And it got to the point where people were like, wow, I watched your video on how to make a Kydex holster. It was great. I learned so much, but can you just make me one? And so the custom side of John's business started to get bigger and bigger, and that kind of became the company that it is today.
Yeah, it went from there. I was working out of the spare room of my house, and then I was like, well, this is really busy. So I got a workshop, and I got a couple people to help me make these things, and it reached a point where a lot of the original Kydex holster makers from the time were starting to realize making every single thing custom is like not sustainable. Like, it becomes hard to develop new things when you're always making stuff that was ordered weeks ago, and we wound up with a wait time, and I'm like, I don't want to have a wait time. So we're like, okay, let's come up with some clean, simple products that we can standardize and sort of pare back on the number of different guns that we make them for. We started doing that, and I had like a CNC router and a vacuum former, and we were making a couple like basic, simple, cleanly done concealment holsters. And that got to a point where, when I was on YouTube, I was also meeting all the other people who were like, I'm figuring this out for myself too. I'm making holsters, and we would share a lot of knowledge. And I've still got a ton of friends from back in the day, and we all were communicating with each other. And a very good friend of mine, Andrew Henry, of Henry Holsters, whose background is in making violins, and he's an absolute genius when it comes to these things. I was busier than I could keep up with, and my process was not good. And Andrew had developed a phenomenal process, but had spare capacity. And I'm like, hey, there's stuff that I want to make that I can't make. I can't get my process to do it. I don't have the time to do it. Let's reimagine these products, put them out through your process, which makes them possible. And then we started a partnership where I design the products and he makes them. And then a couple years later, we changed to a system where now we've got a distributor. So I design products. I have them made in several different places. Like the Enigma is made at Sew Shop in Colorado, and the Express is made at Andrew's factory, and so on and so forth. And our distributor of the activity group, everyone will notice that your Filster products ship from Idaho. They're all at the warehouse there. So that frees us up to design and develop new things kind of relentlessly without having to run a workshop ourselves. We leave the workshop aspect of this to the people who are incredibly proficient at it. And our job here is to develop kind of like the future of holsters. And that's where we are. And the Enigma came from, there's a backstory to the Enigma. So another person who I knew through making holsters was a fellow named Jules. Jules had a company called Runcible Works. And for a number of years, anyone, especially women who had taken ECQC with Craig Douglas, and people who worked in deep concealment plainclothes capacities knew about Runcible Works. And it was a product where it was a holster and a belt all built into one that you would wear under your clothing. And they were all custom, completely handmade. And every single one that I saw was different, because every time Jules made one, he had a slightly different and slightly better idea for how to do it. And I always saw pictures of them, and they looked very, very labor intensive, but they were also completely brilliant. Every single one I looked at, I'm like, there's great stuff in this, and it must take him forever to make these. And everyone I knew who wanted one was like, I've been trying to get a hold of him for weeks. You know, there's a really long wait list. He had a full-time job, you know, with federal law enforcement and didn't always have time to make these things. And I was in a position where we had just revamped the business, different structure. Now all my time can go into developing new products. So I reached out to him. He was located out of New York at the time, and I was in Philly. And I said, hey, come down, bring all of your prototypes and all of your samples for everything, because I want to have a conversation with you about how do we take your holster product and turn it into something that is capable of being mass-produced at all. And so he came down, he spent a day with me, and we filled an entire 18 by 24 sketchbook with just dozens of different designs for how we're going to do this. Like, okay, it's got to be designed for manufacturing. It's got to be simple. It's going to be modular, so we can take advantage of, like, you know, at the time we were just, you know, deep in the nerdery of all of it. And everyone we knew took multiple classes a year and was buying a bunch of holsters from a fairly small number of high-end companies. We're like, okay, it's got to work with everybody's holster that we know. It's got to be able to hold up to all of the things that, like, our, you know, crazy enthusiast friends are going to do with it. It's got to go to jujitsu with you. It's got to go to ECQC with you. It's got to go to USPSA with you. And you got to be able to wear it in anything. And this was at the very end of 2018. And I moved to Minnesota to be with Sarah in 2019. And we had spent the whole year and a half developing this thing. And one day, Sarah came down into my office here, and we had some big sheets of Tegris that we were using for working on some other thing. I had an idea for like a mag pouch and some belt loops for a holster. She's like, can I borrow this? Can I take some of this? I'm like, sure, no problem. And she comes back, and I see that she had cut out this boomerang shape of Tegris and bolted it right to a holster and put a belt on it. And she's like, what do you think about this? And I said, I think I need to call Jules and tell him that he and I just wasted a year and a half of R&D. So I took a couple pictures. Wow. I sent it to Jules, and I said, hey, Sarah just completely cracked the code on this project because we had like Velcro pouches and one wrap, and it was all laser cut, and you could just Velcro it to the holster and all this stuff, and it wasn't ever quite right. And I looked at this, and I'm like, well, this is completely and totally genius, and it fixes like several of the things we were trying to tackle with this. And then we just put the polish on the design and tightened up a few things and said, okay, well, we're going to make it flexible here, and we're going to make it stiff here, and we're going to give it these adjustments, and it's going to have, you know, tuned it around the holsters that we wanted it to fit. And then we went into production, and on day one, we're like, how many of these should we make? Right. We were a tiny company. We had never sold more than 250 of any SKU in a month. Like our most popular product was like, I guess we sell 250 of those a month. That's pretty great. Right. So we're like, okay, we'll make 250 of them. We'll stock them in for Black Friday. And they were, you know, my assumption was that these were going to sell to people who we knew on a first name basis, that like we would recognize from gun class or, you know, from some forum that we're in. Like that would be the limit of it. I would recognize every single name on every single purchase just from being in this scene together. They were gone in 20 minutes. And then we panicked. And then we spent the next year trying to dig ourselves out of the wait list and the growing demand for it. And people think that we hyped it up, but there were months during 2021 where we would see someone order one and we'd recognize their name because they've got 300,000 followers on Instagram. And I would email them and say, when you get this, please do not tell anyone that you have one of these for 6 weeks. Because we're trying to bail ourselves out of this leaking ship of demand. And if you share this with 300,000 people today, we're going to drown. So like, give us a month and a half before you even whisper our name to anyone.
Oh, yeah, people thought we were hyping it up, and we're like, no, we're like begging people not to talk about it yet until we can get some made.
So that's the... Yeah. Enigma story. It's been a crazy couple years. We thought the weirdest, most complicated niche product we had ever designed was going to stay that way. And now it has become the product by which people identify our entire brand. But I think that's kind of for good reason. You know, we set out to make something that was like completely uncompromising in terms of performance. Like, we have high expectations of the people who are going to use this. It is made to wear when you're doing combatives work, like hands-on, jiu-jitsu, ECQC. It holds up, period. You can take it running. You can fight in it. You can take it to a class. There is no context in which you can't use this. And then someone will say it's unsafe or it's inadequate. And then on top of it, it also needs to conceal better than a conventional belt holster. And our goal is to make equipment that people adapt to their body and then therefore to their life without any kind of compromise whatsoever. And we set out to make this thing unapologetically hardcore as a product concept. And it has wound up in a situation where some huge percentage of our customers are people who are like, my Aunt Judy has never owned a gun before, but she bought an Enigma already.
Yeah, it's amazing. We never thought we'd be in this position, and it's an incredible, incredible blessing. But we thought this is going to go to the super hardcore people who have really high standards and really high demands. And we were totally shocked the first time somebody said, hey, I'm looking at the Enigma website and I just need to know, you know, which gun I should buy to go with it. Like, they chose the holster before the gun and they're like, yeah, I'm waiting for my concealed carry permit. I need to pick out a gun to go with this Enigma. And we're like, oh, wow, my goodness. Yeah. And it's been the most incredible opportunity for us, too, as people who have been around this industry for a decade, to kind of put people on the path to becoming skilled and responsible carriers. And I know, especially from a woman's perspective, a lot of the stuff, I mean, you know how the market is, a lot of the stuff that gets marketed to women is just like straight trash, dangerous, unsafe Yes. products, products that don't perform. And so that's kind of, you know, where we came from as an industry. And it used to be that if you wanted high performance, you had to dress like a man. Like you had to wear the tactical pants and you have to have belt loops on every outfit and you have to, you know, make sure that you have baggy enough clothes to hide a gun. And it went from that to being able to put the gun on and then put your clothing on around it however you want. And so it's been like this crazy progression, but such a great opportunity to kind of help people get to that higher standard and that higher level sooner than it, you know, was previously possible.
Yeah, it used to be the kind of situation where if I wanted to access my target customer market, I would develop a relationship with an instructor who had very dedicated high school level students coming to their class, and that they were ahead of me in the funnel. So I could identify people who would like our gear by the fact that they made a $1,000 commitment to take a 2-day class at a very high level of skill. Now we're in a situation where we're way out in front of this funnel. And so we have a great opportunity and kind of an obligation to say to all these new people, okay, you like this product? Here's the world of instruction and knowledge from which it originates. So you want to learn about concealed carry? You've identified yourself as someone who takes this seriously by making a $150 commitment to a product. Let's show you the world that informed all of the values and requirements of this product. And the other thing that it allows us to do, and like this was originally kind of like an emergency, because we had all these people showing up to the brand who didn't have 5 or 10 years of prerequisite experience to understand the product. So we were put in a situation where we're like, okay, how do we take decades of concealed carry experience and all the things that we've come to know intuitively from years of trial and error and condense it down into a repeatable and transferable program that we can put in front of someone who hasn't ever carried a gun before and get them to comfortably conceal at the level that someone who's been doing this for years has done? Because that's what they need to use the product. We're not going to dumb down or dilute the product to the point where a complete novice, you know, we're not going to lower the ceiling on potential for the product to the level of someone who can't make the leap with us. What we want to do is we want to level them up to the product. And so while it was an emergency for a while, and a lot of it we did out of like, okay, well, I've typed the same 4 paragraphs like 24 times this week. Let's make a video out of it so we can explain this at scale. We've created this like huge library of concealed carry, technical information, and repeatable, easy to follow processes for how to do like, okay, you know, like the trial and error thing. A lot of people are like, well, you know, you just got to figure out what works for you with a holster. And people will buy something. There will be something about it that they don't like. They can't quite articulate it and they don't know what the next move should be. So they can't move in any kind of concerted direction. And they don't have the knowledge or the skills to be able to predict what any given holster is going to do once it encounters their body. So once we start talking about things like concealment sweet spot and poke and check and the basics of concealment mechanics, we give people a process that they can follow through and go, okay, this holster is uncomfortable in its printing, but if I do a couple things in a self-diagnostic process, I go, oh, this is where I would need it to be in order for it to do what I want and alleviate that. So now I know exactly where to go next with fine-tuning this or with a different kind of purchase.
Yeah, so our goal was to kind of make a repeatable process that you can start on day one and get to that 10 years experience level faster.
Or at least the results of experience faster.
Yeah. Okay, we've talked for for so long. Do you have questions for us?
No,
I'm sorry. We go on tangent. Like, we just keep, we will fill any amount of time. So feel free to cut us off. Are you writing wrap it up? John's writing wrap it up. I'm glad you wrote that because now I can just tap the sign.
Right. Don't make me tap the sign.
You all are seriously so fun to talk to. I've had to force my cheeks down because I'm getting facial cramps. Like, I've been laughing and smiling so much with you guys. So if I looked really serious at some points, it's because I was making myself do that, by the way. Thank you so much for going on that tangent. That was perfect. I couldn't have prompted that storyline and the origin story any better. So thank you for that. I have more niche questions, but for people that are kind of wondering where they can access this, where would you direct them to?
Well, the easiest way to find all of the educational resources is to go to the Philster website. That's Philster. So philsterholsters.com. And then in the top menu, there's a little menu that says educational resources. So you can find all the good stuff there. So the one that probably the easiest, like, step-by-step start here is called The Basics of Concealment Mechanics. And that starts with, like, literally, like, cartoons, and it goes through some videos, and it's like a step-by-step process. Here's how you do it. Here's how you find the right spot on your body. Here's how you identify what features your holster needs to be to have to conceal in that spot. And then here's how you fine tune it. Here's how you get comfortable.
Yep. And you can also check us out at youtube.com/Philster, where there are a ton of videos.
Yeah. And there are actually so many videos that I recommend going to the playlist section and finding the playlist for what you want. So then you get the whole thing kind of in an organized fashion rather than just picking
right. And you don't have to scroll through all of our instruction videos for products that you might not own yet.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Yes, love playlists. They really, really help out. I'm definitely going to go there myself as soon as possible because so recently I started carrying the PDPF as opposed to my former Glock 19. And even with that subtle change of a pretty like similar sized gun, I've actually had some issues lately with printing. And at one point I was getting so frustrated just changing my outfit. And then I realized I'm not practicing what I preach, which is to use you all as the resource you are, which you're not just pumping out holsters. You are an educational resource. And I'm calling myself out right now because I absolutely need to do that and go to those mentioned places as well. So I think everyone struggles. I feel like concealment isn't just kind of a straight line. I feel like it's more of like a repeated bell curve sometimes, especially if you change your setup. Mm-hmm. And I'm learning that kind of the hard way. And it's kind of been a little bit of an identity crisis because I do identify with concealment and concealment practices and helping people do that. So struggling myself has been a really interesting experience, but I know it's going to lead to better things. So,
And the great thing about that too, is since you are in a public facing role where you're helping people that are not like you, the really cool part about that is it like really makes you sympathize with the struggles that people are going through, and it makes you a better teacher because you understand that better. So like, I know I've gone through similar struggles, and every time I go through it, I'm like, oh, now I really understand why this person said that. And it all it's all part of the process and the journey, and it's a healthy, good thing. So,
I had been carrying a gun religiously for 10 years, and you'll know this as a personal trainer. It was probably about a year ago, I encountered a physical imbalance in my body, insofar as some of the tendons in my right leg for 10 years had been taking a slightly shorter step than my left leg. And there was something very off about how I squatted and I deadlift. So there were a period of a few weeks in there where we were doing some mobility work and a little bit of physical therapy. And I took a break from carrying a gun so that I could give my body a chance to recover and get back to health. And after that, I went and I put a gun back on, and I hadn't felt like a new gun carrier in 10 years. and putting yourself in a position where you now need to, you are reminded about what other people are going through and adapting to is really important. And that experience has informed a lot of what I think about in terms of holsters and equipment in the future. And it's easy to take things for granted when you've been doing it for a while. And it's important to be able to put yourself in the shoes of the people who are coming to you for answers. And in that moment of like, oh, that's right, I forgot that this can be difficult or uncomfortable. I had just gotten so used to it that I needed to give myself a chance to get unused to it so I can actually engage with my product the way a lot of our customers are engaging with it and not take 10 years for granted. And then that goes a long way towards, you know, improving customer experience. How can I help people get through this faster? What things can I make that they can employ as part of that process? I'm also going to pimp one more thing here. If you sign up for the mailing list on our website, you get our free ebook, which is a great place to start in terms of concealment. And also, anyone who makes a purchase on our website gets two emails, one that has all of the instructions for everything that they've purchased, and two, the whole video rundown on all the concealment skills they need to know.
Yeah, and the ebook is actually really cool because it's not just the plain mechanics of concealment, but it also gets a little bit into like the why of the, like the why do we conceal and how do people notice printing and what is printing exactly and why does it stand out to people? So it gets into this at a level of depth that is really helpful if, you know, if you're a nerd like me and John. Or if you're just somebody who likes to understand deeply the things that you're doing, it's got a lot of interesting insight in it.
Absolutely. No, thank you for that. I will absolutely link all of this in the show notes, which are the notes below the title. So if you all just want to go directly to that, it will, these things will all be there, except for the purchase. You'll have to do that part yourself, but it's definitely worth it. So, definitely do that. So you mentioned printing and I were you going to say something? I'm so sorry.
It just occurred to me. I don't know if we have mentioned this yet, but all of our educational resources are completely free and they're all completely product agnostic. So you don't have to buy our products to be able to use these concepts and techniques. So you can use most of this stuff with any holster that has the correct features, which you'll learn how to identify. And you know, you don't have to buy from us in order to benefit from this. And I really encourage people to just learn this stuff. Even like, I don't care if you buy something. I want you to have this knowledge because I want our community to grow and become stronger. And I want people to be more engaged in the community. And that's what happens when people are carrying comfortably. It's like the more people we can get to carry and be comfortable and feel ownership and engagement in the community, like the better the whole Second Amendment movement is. And that is something that's really important to both John and I.
Yeah. One of the things is that going to the range is fun. Buying guns is fun. Taking classes is fun. There are a lot of great on-ramps, right? No one's going to the anti-gun range, right?
Yeah, nobody's right. Going to the gun control range. Like, you're not collecting anti-guns.
Right, and no one's, like, you know, setting up a bunch of watermelons in their backyard and then shooting them with their anti-guns and putting it on YouTube, right? There's just we have all the fun. However, when it comes to concealed carry, it is frustrating and expensive. Typically, that's, you know, just fumble around and guess about it and spend money until you get it right. That's kind of what the path has been. And that's a huge off-ramp for people. People might take their first class. They might get excited about it. They might start to conceal carry and run into all these obstacles and just like throw their hands up and be like, well, I guess that's it. And then they don't go to more classes and then they don't engage in the community quite as much. But if we can eliminate those off-ramps and give people more success and make it more fun, then we're going to have more buy-in.
Yeah, that's super, super important because we've had a wave of new people just due to the pandemic and the social unrest and all this stuff that's been going on in the last few years. We want to ride this wave. Like, we don't want to lose this incredible opportunity to speak to people about the Second Amendment. Right. Just because, like, yeah, it's like, once you get into this stuff, there's some things about owning guns that are difficult. And sometimes it kind of sucks. Carrying a gun kind of sucks. And the more we can help people through that and get them through to the successful, empowering part, the better that is for our entire community. So, you know, we were, up until the pandemic, encountering kind of a crisis of the Second Amendment. Like, what happens when all of the really hardcore old guys that love the Second Amendment, what happens when those guys pass on? Like, what are we going to do? How do we get more young people active and involved? And then, you know, this opportunity kind of fell in our laps, and it's really important for us to make the most of that and get people engaged, get people retained and active in owning this community.
Wow. I honestly feel bad because none of my questions would have ever prompted that. And I'm so grateful that you explained that. That's something I honestly have not thought about a lot. So thank you for bringing that to awareness.
Thanks for the opportunity. It's funny because John has been in the industry a little bit longer than me, but I came in through more of the political side. Like, I started out shooting just for fun, and then I got into competition, and then I got really involved in pro Second Amendment politics. And so that's something that has kind of always been in my frame of reference really heavily. Like, we don't make politics part of our brand, because that's just not, like, we don't think that's very healthy. But it's something that's always kind of in the back of our mind, is like, how can we move this community forward and make sure that the Second Amendment is around after we're dead? And so, anyways, it's it's not related directly to the business, but it's something that's on our minds a lot. So
yeah, I don't think you can separate what we do from the Second Amendment at all. Like, I think you have to be completely committed. We're here for concealed carry. We're here for empowering everyone with these tools. And it's important for us that we are at least part of what enables people to transition from new enthusiast to sustaining community member. And that occurs with positive social interactions. You're part of a group. You're part of a group that likes you, and you're part of a group that you like, and that you get value out of and you enjoy. And that there are low barriers to entry to this participation. And those are significant things. And I don't want to, and I'm talking about lowering barriers for entry without lowering expectations either. And so we want to make this process easier for people without setting them up for failure, and without and without, like, dumbing anything down.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. So anyways, our business is not related to any politics other than Second Amendment politics. We're very, very big tent. Like, it doesn't matter what you believe. If you believe in this, then as far as this is concerned, we're on the same team. But yeah, we do occasionally go off on a the occasional pro-gun political rant. So
absolutely,
there you go.
Feel free to. This is seriously an opportunity for you all to, if you would like to continue on that path and speak to that anymore, please feel free to.
Are you in search of top-notch gear that exceeds your expectations? Look no further than GPS, brought to you by Go Outdoors Incorporated. GPS has been dedicated to crafting the finest products for hunting and shooting since 2002. As someone who frequents the gun range, my GPS bag is a staple to safely and effectively haul my gear. Their specialized bags are designed to keep all of my valuable equipment secure and organized. With GPS, you can experience the ultimate peace of mind. Their three exciting product lines, GPS Tactical, GPS GPS Wild About Hunting and GPS Wild About Shooting provide the perfect solution for your specific needs. So whether you're on a hunting expedition or hitting the range, GPS is your reliable companion. To choose a bag that fits your needs, use code SHEESHIELD at checkout to save and to support the pod. That's SHEESHIELD at checkout.
I think I got it out of my system.
Yeah, I mean, what I would encourage people to do is if the Second Amendment is something that you are passionate about and it's something that's important to you, one of the best things you can do is to learn how to communicate about it better with people who don't agree with you. And John and I made a podcast about that a couple of years ago called Guns Guide to Liberals. It's kind of a play off of the Liberals Guide to Guns. It's the other way around, right? Like, you're going to be, as the pro Second Amendment person, you are going to be the guide and the entry point for your friends and family who don't understand it. And so it's about how to communicate with people who disagree, people who might be hostile, people who might not have very good boundaries. The whole podcast is just about communication strategies to make the Second Amendment more understandable to people. And also along the way to preserve your relationships with your friends and family who might not always agree with you on everything. So, and so there's that. That's a good start. And then if you're interested in becoming more politically active, I highly recommend that you start at the state level, because that's one of the places where you can have the most bang for the buck.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. So if your state has a good pro-gun group, don't be fooled by the crappy ones. There are some crappy ones, but if you volunteer, you'll sort out the crappy ones from the good ones really quick, because most of the crappy ones don't have a lot of volunteer opportunities. Whereas the good groups are like, please volunteer, we're begging you. So volunteer, give them your time. If you don't have time, you can contribute money. Whatever it is that you have available to you as a resource, that's something that you can put towards your things that are politically important to you as well. So,
yeah.
Highly encourage that.
As far as any arena of political activity goes, there is plenty of grift to go around, but you can avoid that. Great way to do it is to look for organizations that have results associated with them. You'll see on their website, we are taking action in the following ways. We are involved in this lobbying effort and this lawsuit and this and that and the other thing, and here's the list of successes that we've had, right? That's a great way to identify them. If their website is mostly geared towards making you panic and send the money, it might be a grift.
Right. Right. Yeah, and there are quite a few of those out there too. But there's an article called Six Ways to Know Your, or no, it's called Six Signs Your Gun Rights Organization is a Scam. And that was an article I wrote for Recoil a while back, and it had some info about how to sort the good ones from the bad ones. So it's all stuff that you can learn on your own. It's nothing difficult or you don't have to be an industry insider to know which groups are good if you just kind of learn how to screen them. So,
and if that's too much work for you and you want to participate at the national level, we highly recommend Firearms Policy Coalition. We are in the process of doing all the more complicated and technical work than we thought it was going to be, to set up a system on our website that when you check out, you can donate or round up to FPC, because we really believe in what they're doing, and they're doing great results everywhere. That's Firearms Policy Coalition.
Yeah. Absolutely. I will link all of that in the show notes and the article, the FPC, everything you've mentioned. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. I've actually never kind of brought up politics on the show, but I absolutely love your intentions with it, and definitely wanted you all to keep speaking on that. So thank you so much.
Absolutely.
To go a little bit back to the concealment side, unless there's anything else you think of you would like to talk about, I'd like to talk about printing. On my social media platforms, I've gotten a lot of comments, and actually think I responded to one of your stories, John. I don't know if you all are on the same social media? Are you guys both, do you guys both run Filster or is it separate?
Oh, I'm okay. Filster Instagram.
Yes. Okay. Okay. So when I think I responded to a story where you mentioned, someone said something about how printing doesn't really bother them. And, we talked a little bit about that and I've been getting a lot of, not DMs, it's been mostly comments like printing doesn't bother me, you know, like this is too much work, you're paranoid kind of thing. So I would love if you all would address kind of the issue with printing and your opinion on that.
So you caught me at exactly the right time for this. Sarah has put out a couple of videos on YouTube lately that have been performing really well. And that means a lot of YouTube comments.
Yes.
If I have to see another comment that says, nobody cares that you're printing, I don't know what the big deal is, I am going to have a brain aneurysm. Like, I've read that comment so many times that I wish every comment box came with like one of those CAPTCHA boxes. And it's like, instead of check, are you a robot? I wish it said, did anyone fucking ask you?
So that's the thing about it though, is like, if you don't think printing matters, then you're right. And if you do think printing matters, then you're right. Because nobody can tell you your context and your lifestyle and your circumstances. So like for me, say, for example, if I were employed somewhere where there's a no weapons policy and I'm spotted with a gun, that ends my career. I'm now trying to pay back my student loans on a McDonald's salary. And I am now in the hole for the next two, maybe three decades over that printing incident. So does printing matter for me? Absolutely, it does. Now take, for example, say John's from a small town where everybody carries and everybody knows that everybody carries and nobody cares. Does printing matter for John? No, it really doesn't. So
yeah, I mean, when people say no one's ever noticed me printing, they're saying I've never been around really dangerous people or in a context where this could have consequences. I mean, just because no one has ever said anything to you doesn't mean they noticed. When was the last time any of us walked up to a stranger at a gas station or a grocery store and said, "Hi, stranger, your fly is open"? That has never happened. I've never had a stranger do that to me or for me, and I've never done it to anyone, ever. You have to be familiar with someone before you point out that faux pas to them. Right, I might tell someone that their shoe's untied, but I'm definitely not going to tell them that their fly's open. How many people do you think are going to walk up to the person with a gun and say, "Hey, mister, I can see your gun," just as a courtesy? Like, that's never going to happen. The other thing to keep in mind is not that nobody notices you printing. It's that nobody who matters notices you printing. People say, "Oh, well, I don't worry about printing. Everyone's just so distracted and on their phone all the time." I don't carry a gun because of the people who are distracted and on their phone all the time. This is the same. Here's the analogy that I make. I tell this. Imagine we're inventing a brand new stealth aircraft, right? We've been tasked. We've been said, you guys got to develop a stealth aircraft. And I go, okay, great. And I come back into the meeting room and I'm like, okay, so we've got it all figured out. And they're like, that was fast. I'm like, yeah, okay. So we figure at any given time, 99.9% of the population isn't looking at the sky. So we don't need to develop a new technology. We don't need to mitigate the radar signature of this. We don't need to do anything to this plane because fundamentally people just aren't looking at the sky. They're not looking for planes. But what about the people who are? Well, there's so few of them, you'll never run into them statistically. Which is, all of that's true. The number of radar operations per 100,000 people is really low. I'm not going to bump into one on the street, but you can be damn sure that every single one of them is looking at the sky just for you. And if, I mean, every time I go out, I spot someone who's printing. Every time. There's always...
You've spotted one at the airport before.
Yeah, I mean, I've spot air marshals, spot off-duty cops, and spot civilians. They're everywhere. And if I can notice, do you want to bet that someone who has spent a lifetime as a criminal is also really alert to this? They notice each other carrying guns. They notice who may or may not be a cop. And the chances that one of them has had a gun pointed at them or has been shot at some point is extremely high. What are you going to do when they are A, not surprised by the fact that you have a gun, and B, not scared of it? Why would you ever, like the kind of person who is going to attack you not knowing that you have a gun, and the kind of person who is going to attack you with the full and complete knowledge that you have a gun and are going to deploy it, are two very different people. And one of them is someone I do not want to have anything to do with. And I would much rather prefer to surprise them. You know, like the three key elements of an ambush are speed, surprise, and violence of action. No one says, yeah, I think we can do a great ambush if we don't have surprise. That's a fundamental criteria of the activity. If I'm deploying a pistol in self-defense from concealment, I want that to come as a complete surprise that dramatically reorients the nature of the attack. I don't want them to go into the attack knowing that they need to prevent me from getting my gun. I don't want them to go into the attack with an instantaneous level of violence that's going to incapacitate me, like knock me out first and then take my gun. The number of advantages that you gain by being able to surprise someone in an attack are incredibly high. If none of that's a priority for you and you live in a place which is safe and no one actually cares that you're printing and that your life and your job don't have any consequences for detection attached to them, that's fine. But that doesn't mean you can turn around to the entire population and say, well, nobody notices you printing. Back when I lived in Philadelphia, I take the subway a lot of places, and there were a lot of bad neighborhoods. I mean, my first shop was, like, I watched people do heroin on the street out of the window of my first workshop. There are a lot of folks in Philly who, if they notice that you have a gun and they don't think you're very hard, they will test you about it. Printing really matters. You don't want to be detected. You don't want someone to walk up to you on the subway and say, you have a gun, I can tell, let's do something about it. Because they're already four moves ahead of you in this game. I'd rather be undetected. And that really came from the context that I carried a gun in. But that's not everyone.
Yeah, and I do think there are some gender differences there as well, because, like, say you're a 6'4" muscular dude and you look like you spend a lot of time in the martial arts studio, the number of people who are going to see your gun and say, oh yeah, I could take him, I could take that gun, that's a low number. But if you are 5'2" and you weigh 120 pounds, and you don't look that tough, the number of people who see your gun and say, oh, I know I could take that gun off her, that's a much higher number of people, right? And just statistically, it's like something like the average man is stronger than, like, I forget what percentage, than like 99% of women. And the 99th percentile woman is only as strong as the average man. So it's like, when you look at those differences and you think about whether printing matters, if somebody's sizing you up, it really matters a lot if you're not going to, if they're sizing you up and thinking that you are looking, not looking tough, right?
Yeah, fundamentally, I don't think I don't think the people who say that printing doesn't matter have enough cauliflower ear to make that statement.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, you should really have to earn the right to make that statement. It's just, yeah. So again, you know, like, people's contexts are so different. I'm not going to tell them that they're wrong for their context. Like, that's yours. You get to choose that. But I can definitely tell them that they're wrong to apply it to others. That's really what bugs me about it. I don't care that people have low standards. Like, you can have whatever standards you want. Just don't try to push your low standards on everyone.
The other thing is our mission is to provide people who prioritize zero signature of carrying a gun with tools and techniques that help them accomplish that. Luck and optimism are not repeatable, transferable tools and techniques. Get over it and hope no one notices isn't a system by which you take control of the visible signature of your gun. Like, saying that no one notices you printing, as far as I'm concerned, is the same as saying combat accuracy is good enough, right? As long as you're getting hits anywhere on the torso, that's more than enough shooting right. that you need. Well, I want to be in control of where these rounds land on the target. And with not that much more work, you can be completely in control of that. There's no reason that you cannot be in control of how much visible signature there is of your gun. We've got the tools for it. We've got the techniques for it. We've got the systems for doing it. And hoping that nobody notices isn't actually a tool for being in control of whether anyone notices. Like, I can't think of something less helpful to contribute to a conversation about, like, hey, I want to reduce the visible signature of my pistol in a variety of contexts that are important to me because of the consequences attached to this activity. And if someone comes along and says, oh, nobody notices, you haven't actually given them anything helpful.
And, yeah, that's worse than
right.
wrong.
And there's two factors to this, right? Because one is the physical discomfort that comes from carrying a gun. And most of the time when you're printing, there's a corresponding physical discomfort, right? You know, when your gun is tipping out away from your body and the slide and the grip are printing and the muzzle's poking you, when you fix the printing, you're also fixing the comfort issue. Those things are interconnected. The other thing is the psychological discomfort that comes from carrying a gun, especially when you're new. People spend a lot of time trying to get over it because they don't actually have any other mechanism for addressing the psychological discomfort that comes with it. However, the best way to address psychological discomfort in general is taking control over the circumstances that cause you discomfort. That's any kind of anxiety. That's any kind of, you know, even stuff like trauma. Like, you take control over the things that are causing you psychological distress. The best way to fix the psychological distress in any degree that it occurs from feeling extremely conspicuous about carrying a gun is taking control over that, not get over it. Get over it is terrible advice for just about anything. Like, no one ever just gets over it. You need tools and strategies and systems for taking control of the feelings and circumstances surrounding your experience. That's just fundamentally true.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Well said.
That was so, yes, I was about to say, so well said. Yes, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. Thank you for not tapping the sun.
No, I did not. You were on a roll. It was really good, though.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yes, literally.
You guys are so funny. Yes. Nice. Wrap it up. Yes. The box and the underline makes it so much better. That's awesome. Yeah. No, thank you for going into that. I feel like the mental and emotional health side of self-defense is not addressed enough. Mm-hmm. I'm just now realizing how before I started my, I just call it a gun page to keep it simple, but I'd like to, you know, it's more of a concealment journey page as my eye twitches anyway, because I'm still learning. But anyway, I first had a fitness and mental health journey kind of like directive for that page. And when I started posting more about my self-defense and firearms journey, that started getting a lot of attention. Some women started saying just that they loved that I was a new resource, that they didn't find, they hadn't found a lot of female resources for concealment. And I kind of dropped off the fitness and mental health side a little bit, but I'm starting now that I'm getting further in my journey, I'm realizing how much of those how much physical and mental health play into a good foundation for self-defense, mm-hmm. being physically fit to sprint, you know, 400 meters and being mentally healthy enough to own a firearm in your home where you experience kind of some of your worst mental health moments. And I love that you brought that to the table because it needs to be said more. So, and that was part of why She Shield was started in general, is to bring those types of topics to the forefront that maybe aren't as glorious and shiny, you know? So thank you for talking about that. Kind of the next topic I'd like to ask you is, I kind of thought of it based on what you just said. If you were to speak to someone who's just now getting into concealed carry and they asked you where they should go with their training, they're not interested in competition shooting, they're not interested in being really any more knowledgeable than the average citizen. I don't want to say the average citizen with a gun because that's just bad, but they're wanting to be more prepared than the average citizen. What type of training would you point them to?
Oh, absolute instant first no-brainer. We're going to both say it at the same time. John Murphy's street encounter skills.
Yeah.
Yes.
FPF training. John Murphy travels all over the country. He is, this is going to make him sound like a vagrant, but he's more of like a traveling monk. He travels all over the country in his RV that he calls Maslow. As in, it meets all of his, you know, it's
the hierarchy of needs
and it sustains his life. And I love
that so much.
He teaches, if someone could only take one single class after their permit to carry class, it would be John Murphy's street encounter skills. It goes over, it's like a chef's tasting menu of all of the necessary skills that you need to be a competent self-defender. You can take it at any level of pistol skill. It's not like going to teach you how to shoot. It involves first aid, managing unknown contacts, pepper spray, scenario, and live fire. And there's a great there's work to do before the class with a ton of videos to watch.
Yeah, and those are actually all free on YouTube, so you can watch those now. And I would highly recommend that because it's an incredible intro to the world of self-defense. And the other thing about John's class, so we shoot because it's fun. And we get really, some of us anyways, get really into the technical side of shooting because it's fun and rewarding and it's instant gratification when you shoot that shot and you get it just right. And it's fun. And there's also like an adventure component where you want to go and like do some cool, like Navy SEAL training or, you want to take this like, you want to challenge yourself and push yourself and have this adventure. And we do this stuff because it's fun, but it's not really all that useful. And I'm not downgrading the fun part, and I'm not saying don't learn how to shoot well.
Right.
But I'm saying those classes fill really fast because they're fun and they're kind of like bragging rights and it's the cool guy stuff. But what's really unique about John's class is I think that he takes all of the peripheral skills, the ones that actually matter, the decision-making stuff that is more important to whether or not you're going to survive your encounter than whether or not you have a sub-second draw or a 1.1 second draw. Like, this is the stuff that's more important, but John actually takes that stuff and makes it fun. That's the cool part, because this is all like, sometimes that stuff can be a little bit less glamorous. Like, this is the stuff that people need to work on, but they don't know they need it. And so they're attracted to like the flashy, stupid stuff that's not actually helpful. But John has found a way to take the important stuff and make it engaging and fun. His teaching and his learning theory is like, it's so good that you take this class and you're entertained while you're learning. And the whole experience is one that you're like, wow, that was like one of the best classes I've ever taken.
Yeah, the class is a huge pile of broccoli that is going to be good for you.
Yeah.
And John puts just enough Velveeta on it that you want to keep eating it.
Exactly. Exactly. Because one thing I've noticed, and this has been on my mind a lot recently as well, just in this industry and with concealment, I'll speak to it from this perspective. So when a new person comes into the Filster Concealment Workshop Facebook group, which is our user group, where we just talk about concealment with anyone who comes to show up to chat with us. So people enter this group and they have a really good idea of what they think they want and what they think they need. And what they actually need is not that. Like the thing that they have in their head, like, oh, I just need this and this and this. And they come into it and you're like, no. You need a skill. You don't need to buy a thing. You need to learn a skill. And that's really hard for people. They don't want to hear it. They want the quick solution. They want the easy thing that they can just buy and make everything fine. But it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, none of that works without the skill.
And everyone in there has got some piece of equipment that they are very emotionally attached to, and it's important to them for whatever reason. And it's really hard to tell people, like, this is not the thing you need to be successful. So what I really like about John Murphy's class is that he is giving you the things you need, but you didn't know to want them.
It's also a great introduction. Like we were talking about previously, we're funneling people back into the world that our product came from. When you start talking about people like Craig Douglas and you know, events like Rangemaster Tactical Conference, John Murphy's class is an extremely accessible way to be introduced to the concepts and follow-on classes. It introduces you to the progression that you could be taking if you were so inclined to be more interested beyond the initial class. And the other great thing about the class is that it doesn't matter what skill level you're at. You know, if you are new to shooting, it's going to tell you where you are and where you need to be and give you a barometer for what you're capable of. If you have high levels of pistol performance automaticity, it's going to give you an accurate audit of how well you can deploy those skills when you're doing other things mentally. Now, I want to talk about something that comes up a lot because we're involved in concealment and sometimes deep concealment. And this relates to John's class. We do a lot of work as far as pistol performance goes that starts with the timer going beep, right? And we measure from the expected predetermined start time to execute a skill that we've already decided to do to measure how quickly we can react and perform that skill. Great. You know, 1.85 second build drill. 0.89 draw to first shot. That's great. These are tests of automaticity. However, there is time that occurs before the beep in any life-threatening event that we don't really measure. Now, folks like John Correa at Active Self-Protection have done some really interesting stuff by looking at videos and determining where opportunities are. So like if someone in an event shows you their ear when they look away from you, that's an indication that you have 1.5 seconds to do something. If someone turns completely away from you, that means that your window starting at that moment of recognition is 2 seconds. There's time before the beep. There's time to engage or disengage or evaluate or reposition or make a series of decisions and look for a series of cues, pre-assault indicators, you know, direction of gaze, the attacker's intentions, what they're doing. And the beep occurs when you have the time and timing on your side to deploy a pistol. What the class is great at doing is exploring the time that occurs before the beep. And one of the things that we really relate to in that context is that concealment is a tool that allows you to take the most advantage of the time before the beep. Because if you're detectable, then you're selectable. But if you're invisible and you're part of the landscape, then you can change your position relative to whatever's happening in your context. You can manage the pace and the scale of the engagement. You know, when you're encountering someone who might be unknown or hostile, and the gun isn't immediately present from their perspective. So you can buy time before the beep. And John's class is a great opportunity for learning about what those windows are and how you personally behave in those circumstances and how you make the decision between what tools you're going to deploy and what you're recognizing about that situation. And if you're at a lower skill level, you can't do as much in any given particular window. And it's important to recognize that so you don't overplay what you're doing. You don't try to solve a 2-second problem with a 4-second draw. You know, you don't get out over your skis in self-defense. And then from the other perspective, if you've got high levels of pistol automaticity, you can find out exactly how much of your brain processing power you need to deploy that. You know, like how much RAM do you need to get a 1.5-second draw to first shot while you're multitasking these other things?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it gets really interesting, too, when you think, like, you may not have the fastest draw in town, but if you are faster at recognizing that this situation is about to go down, positioning yourself and getting yourself in the most advantageous situation, you can make up for that slower draw time, right? So it's like you start sooner, even though you're not faster, but you still get there, you know, at the same time. So
yeah,
it gets really interesting. You learn a lot about yourself. So, but that John's class is not the only class where you can learn these skills. It's one of the best, like, comprehensive places to do it. Let's see, if somebody's going to just start training though, from scratch, where would you recommend that they
completely from scratch? I think it depends a lot on their location.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there's a lot to be said for just building a baseline proficiency. And the main thing about that is,
Hang on. I got it. I don't mean to interrupt you. Starting at a smaller level with a local instructor kind of depends a lot on your location. However, we have an enormous community at the Filster Concealment Workshop, which consists of a lot of instructors and people who are willing to give advice. So if you're just starting out, you can join our group, and inevitably someone will be able to refer you to quality and vetted instruction in your local area, at least at the state level. It might not be within 15-minute drive of you, but it will definitely be fairly nearby.
Yeah, and what I was going to say is that, like, there's a lot to be said for building your baseline shooting proficiency, but the most important thing you can do, if you want to protect your life, the number one most important thing you can do is build your safety skills and get those automatic first. Because if you look at the math, statistically, you know, the odds that you will successfully deploy your gun and shoot somebody who's attacking you, those odds are really low. But, you know, how many thousands of times over your life are you going to reholster your gun while it's on your body? So making sure that you don't shoot yourself is really the most important place you can start. And so you can learn that by working with an instructor. And the other thing I really highly recommend people do is record yourself. Practice reholstering as a separate skill and record yourself doing it, because everybody and their brother will swear up and down, oh no, I wouldn't. I know the gun safety rules. I would never point my gun at myself. I would never muzzle my hand. I would never point the gun into my pelvis as I'm trying to reholster. But once you actually see them on a recording, you're like, well, yeah, you just did it there. Here's a screenshot where I drew a line exactly where your muzzle was pointing. They're like, oh, I didn't know I was doing that. So don't let that be you. Your time, learn those skills. And record yourself and check yourself and make sure that you are aware of any places you might be slipping so that you can fix them before you have an accident.
Yeah, more people are going to point a loaded gun at themselves by accident than any criminal will ever point at them on purpose.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to talk about where to divert your resources to get the most bang for your buck, pun not intended, safety skills are number one.
Absolutely. I remember when I first got into concealment, I sent a video to Tessa from Armed and Styled. Mm-hmm. And I was asking her about my draw and she pinpointed my reholstering. And I was so surprised. I didn't even think about it. And I made a whole post on it like the next day. And I, of course, you know, tagged her and thanked her. And I had not thought about that. I was flagging myself. It was like I was competing for how fast I could reholster. It was really funny. I've seen some really funny memes.
People
on, like,
only people lose that competition.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
But no,
first place
but
is getting shot.
That is the really interesting little thing about human nature is that we all can understand and learn and recite the rules of gun safety. But because you can recite the rules, that doesn't mean that you can actually put them into practice in a live scenario, even just at home, you know, in front of your bedroom mirror. And that's a normal disconnect that people have. You don't realize you're doing it until you actually see yourself doing it. And then you're like, oh, yeah. So this is very normal. And that's why I really want to normalize people recording themselves and analyzing that and critiquing it. Because you will not notice. You're going to think that you're doing everything safely until you have an expert eye on you. You don't know what you don't know. So that's actually really cool that you realize that and that you took that step, because a lot of people never do.
And if you're going to practice at home and do a bunch of dry fire to keep yourself, you know, as part of keeping yourself safe, I highly recommend picking up Annette Evans' book called The Dry Fire Primer. And a significant portion of that is about how to get ready to dry fire and how to create the safe and risk mitigated circumstance in which you can do that while lowering the likelihood of you sinking a bullet into the wall of your house.
Yeah, yourself.
Yes. Or yourself. So just from the perspective of reading something that goes into depth about risk mitigation in the context of what we feel are relatively normal and casual firearms handling practices, just that part of the book will also reshape how you think about gun handling in general. Mm-hmm. Even outside the context of dry fire, and how to not treat risk mitigation casually. I think what happens with a lot of people is that they get a lot of experience, mm-hmm. and
they get real comfortable.
There's something about people never want to show off being careful. We see a lot of people. They'll be like shooting something on Instagram and they'll just throw their gun away and turn to the camera and start talking to you. And it's like, hey, that didn't actually make you look cooler and more confident. Like,
right.
It's okay to speed reholstering isn't like a badge of authority or expertise. It's every time I see it, have you ever been around like an art class full of kids and they're doing the linoleum cutting? And there's like the one kid like cutting towards their hand with the really sharp blade. You know, every time I see someone fling their gun back into the holster, it's the same as watching someone like, you know, just taking the biggest, sharpest knife they have and cutting that bagel while they're holding it or like cutting towards themselves with something. And I'm just like, I can't watch. I can't right. watch. I mean, I'm assuming that because they posted the video, there's no gunfire involved, but like...
You never know anymore.
Right.
But it's just leading to one of those things. And like,
yes,
especially when it comes to concealment holsters, mm-hmm. your body's in the way, your garments are in the way, you're putting the gun in incredibly close and intimate proximity with your body. And the closer you bring the gun to your body, the harder it is to keep the muzzle averted. And one of the things that I was talking about with someone about the other day is they were giving the typical, like, man, I just don't know how anyone appendix carries. It's so unsafe and this and that and the other thing. How do I get over the feeling that appendix carry is unsafe? I'm like, well, to be completely honest, most of the people who are carrying at 3 or 4 o'clock just cannot see themselves doing the things that are more unsafe than if they appendix carried, right? Like, if a lot of 3 to 4 o'clock carriers could actually see what they were doing outside their field of vision with that gun, they wouldn't feel safe about what they were doing there. I've seen so many people take a pistol and just point it crossways through their pelvis to get it back in the holster. And I'm like, if you shot yourself like that, there's no tourniquet you can put on there, right? That is going through your pelvis and through some vitals. Or on the way out from the draw, they angle the gun in towards themselves. Like the number of things that people, or they just sweep their leg when they're putting the gun back in the holster. And like,
right.
They're not currently doing, I'm like, okay, ask yourself this. What am I doing right now that mitigates the risk of self-inflicted gunshot wound for 3 to 4 o'clock carry? And how can I translate that over to appendix carry? If your answer is nothing, then you're not any safer doing any other practice.
Yeah, it's just behind your back, so you don't see it.
It's just out of sight, out of mind.
Right.
It's just as dangerous. You're just not aware. You're not witnessing the danger.
That makes a lot of sense. I actually recently, not even a few days ago, saw one of my favorite content creators. She's an instructor. I don't think she's in the United States, but I just love her instructional work. She really tries to break down her videos to like the common viewer, but her reholstering is the one thing that has always really stressed me out because she'll be looking at the camera and smiling while she's like trying to find her holster, and she's essentially just stabbing at it.
Oh gosh.
It's so interesting because she's at such a high level with marksmanship and followers, but her reholstering is bad. And it's just interesting. I'm so glad you touched on that because it is just, it's so important. And honestly, if Tessa hadn't told me, I don't know how long I would have gone with just flagging myself, probably up until the point, actually of ECQC, because Craig Douglas really does touch on reholstering. He talks about the wrist motion and he breaks down inside the waistband as opposed to outside. And, he pays really close attention to that. So it probably would have been up to that point, but then it just would have been really embarrassing.
Right. You know, that's not the place you want to.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Cannot disappoint exactly. Uncle Craig.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Well, as far as questions I have for you all covered everything and more than I could have possibly dreamed. And that is in the best way possible. So before we sign off, because we are about at time, I would love for you all to kind of tell us your plans for Filster, long-term plans, as much as you can say. I know that there's probably some stuff in the works you can't say quite yet, but is there anything you would like to share?
Yeah, I've actually been thinking about this a lot. We have incredibly cool new things coming up in the near-term future. We teased them, but the holster wedge kit that we've been talking about for a while is getting really close. So one of the things we're focused on making holsters human, and we're focused on making it all easier. So one of the things that is tough is fine tuning the holster to fit your body. I don't fundamentally think that there's any reason that holsters should be shaped like guns when you're wearing them inside the waistband. They should be shaped like bodies. Fine-tuning your holster, making a wedge, finding the right wedge, huge process of trial and error. So we are very close to launching the holster wedge kit, which is a bunch of these little plastic encapsulated foam pads that are covered in fabric. And you trim them out of here and you can Velcro them to each other and stack them up into all different shapes and sizes. So those are 99% done. We're going to have those ready really soon. Yep, you've got those. We've been working on the RF welding to get these perfect. And then we have cool new stuff coming at the end of the year,
which we have solemnly vowed not to tease until it is in our warehouse, because we have been burned by COVID shortages and machine downtime and all of, like, we've been burned so many times. That, like, oh yeah, we're gonna have this by next week, and we start teasing it, and now it's like 4 months later. Nope. So we're not gonna talk about it until it's ready, but it's gonna be cool.
I will say three things. We're patenting it, we're trademarking it, and it is going to be the future of how we make all of our holsters going forward.
Wow.
Definitely not mysterious.
it. No, not at all. That is so exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we're pretty excited.
Very excited stuff. We have a vision for what we think the future of holsters should be. And how they integrate and interface with the human body. And how those things work together to allow people to seamlessly, as quickly as possibly, and with the greatest amount of success and the fewest compromises, if any, bring a gun into their life and carry it all the time. And we are in the process of dramatically reducing the barriers to people's success with that without a product that has any performance compromise associated with it whatsoever. And that's our goal for the next couple of years.
Yeah, you know, no big deal.
No big deal.
That's wonderful. I can see what you all come out with and share that with pretty much everyone. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you, too. It's been a good conversation, and we've enjoyed it.
We've been looking at your Instagram for ages, we're like, she's got something going on.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It means everything coming from you too. And thank you for staying with me through my cringy posts. We talked about this a little bit before I hit the record button, but I've definitely revised some of my past work. So yes, thank you for staying with me even through those periods of just extreme learning curves, essentially.
Yeah,
so,
that's good. That's how it should be.
It's hard to learn in public.
Exactly. I know. I'm grateful for the fact that there was no social media when I was going through a lot of my my learning, because it is really hard to learn in public. John's right.
Oh yeah, like, and we didn't have social media in any real way until we were in our mid-20s. Thank God.
Yeah, and I do think, like, the thing that we can do, though, as people who are now kind of becoming trying to be leaders in the industry, is that we can normalize learning in public. So learning in public means changing your mind. It means improving. It means revising. And it means being wrong about things. And that's okay. And I don't say that in a lowering of standards way. Like, no, it's not okay to just continue doing things wrong, but it's okay to learn and progress and get better. And that's something we should be celebrating, not like going back to January of 2017, where she said this and it was wrong, and let's use that against her forever. Like, no. If we're all going to learn in public like this, we can't do that anymore. So we need to evolve our industry.
Yeah. And fundamentally, part of having thoughts and finding out what you're actually thinking involves talking to other people about it. And this is one of the reasons that free speech is so fundamentally important, is that in order to think anything through at all, you almost always have to have at least a dialogue with someone, right? Most people don't actually even know what they're thinking until they start speaking it out loud. I mean, just from a basic level, as soon as you start talking, no one knows exactly what words they're going to use to end a sentence and in what order, if you're coming up with it off the top of your head. So you don't actually know what you think until you start talking, one. Two, communicating with other people about it is one of the best ways to actually resolve the murky goo of electric energy into your head into complete thoughts. And so you kind of have to do that out loud, and you kind of have to do it in public, and you kind of have to share what you're thinking in order to even make it concrete at all. Everyone can write in their journal, but you don't get feedback on that, right? Your diary isn't going to tell you.
There's no peer review process.
Right. You're going to do, dear diary, I felt bad about this today. Your diary is never going to say, hey, you know, have you thought about thinking about it differently? You know, like, that's part of having the thoughts. And so one of the advantages of social media is that now you're connected to a whole bunch of other brains that can give you important feedback and help you solidify your thoughts. The other problem is that it's a permanent record about every dumb thing you ever thought or said.
Yes.
And I think part of adjusting to social media is
We just got to forgive that stuff.
It's got to be forgivable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to be normal to change your mind. Because what happens to a lot of people is they have one idea and they get a lot of positive feedback on it. And then now that's the only idea they have anymore.
Yeah, because the only one they're allowed to have too.
Right.
Yes. But you know, like we are in a position where we are shaping the culture. So it is to an extent what we say it is. And if we start to say like, it's okay to learn in public, then it becomes okay to learn in public. So I think that's something that we can all do consciously as we move forward.
I love that. Thank you so much. Yes. The first date night video I did with a sweater dress, I was printing so badly and it sent me on this journey to figure it out because I wanted to be able to carry in a sweater dress. It was wintertime. Women had been DMing me about how to carry in a dress. And I really wanted to create content for them and give them ideas. And I kept that first version, but I went back to that video and edited the caption and said, go see my 2.0 version because my first one was very bad. And so I won't delete that type of content where it's kind of a turnaround, but the things I have deleted from like 5 years ago, that stuff is just not helpful to anyone. So we'll just leave that alone. So I make it sound really, really bad. It's just cringy to me, which, you know, we are our own worst critics sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to leave that alone. But other than that, is there anything you would like to kind of send the listeners off with today before we end?
Yeah. Wrap it up.
Wrap it up.
Wrap it up, Fox.
If you're listening to the audio only, we're pointing at the sign that says wrap it up.
It's like that Chappelle Show sketch.
Yeah,
the music. We should have the music from the Dave Chappelle Show Wrap It Up Box sketch programmed into the road board, so we can just hit the button and play the music.
Yeah,
did it play?
I think so, but it's funny.
No, I love it. I thank you guys for sharing that with me. And if you guys want this video footage, you can become a Patreon. Nice little. Transition into the end of show notes, but yeah, exclusive content, stickers, and
hi, Patreon.
Thank you notes. you all can get that if you become one. That will be in the show notes as well. You can visit the SheShield Instagram and TikTok at SheShield Pod for pictures of our guest speakers and podcast highlights. A special thank you to Sagetta Gear, the official sponsor of SheShield, for any concealed carry gear and duty gear. You can use code SheShield10 for 10% off of your Sagetta Gear order. All sources mentioned in this episode will be listed in the show notes, like I said before. And if you like the pod, you can help by liking, subscribing, and leaving a review. Thank you for listening. And in the meantime, stay safe and stay vigilant. Thank you, Sarah and John, for coming on today. This has been an incredible episode.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate you all so much. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Bye, guys. Attention all knife enthusiasts. Today's episode is sponsored by the one and only Cold Steel Knives. For over three decades, Cold Steel has been leading the way in the knife industry, dedicated to creating the world's strongest and sharpest blades. They've pioneered countless innovations that have become industry hallmarks of quality and sophistication. From their revolutionary checked Kraton handles to the iconic Tanto point blade systems, Cold Steel's progressive accomplishments have set new standards in the field. Their trademark triad locking mechanism remains unrivaled by any of their competitors, proving its unbeatable performance time and time again. Their impressive lineup goes beyond just knives. They offer swords, tomahawks, machetes, cutlery, and a wide range of tools for everyday carry. Trusted by military, law enforcement, emergency services, self-defense professionals, and martial arts practitioners, Cold Steel is renowned for quality, strength, reliability, and dependability. Where strength, safety, and performance come together for over three decades and counting, use code SHEShield at checkout, that's SHEShield, to save and to support the pod.